question, you know. Brotherly or sisterly love, not so much, but I don't think it was held in the same way. Certainly, when we think about the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha couldn't exist harmoniously without love. And I think the Buddha or any monastic would have said so. But would they have called it L-O-V-E, which is such a powerful word in our culture? I don't know. I think, you know, when I think about the Brahma-viharas more generally, you know, many of my teachers have spoken about the Brahma-viharas as just different manifestations of the open heart, whether, you know, in response to, friendly connection, you know, the metta, or whether karuna or compassion in response to suffering, or so on. And, you know, I think for many people, metta carries that flavor, is probably the word and the practice that carries the flavor of love the most. So, and certainly metta's in the suttas, and the Brahma-viharas are in the suttas quite a bit.
Do you mean romantic love? Two tarnate? I mean, there are different flavors of love, of course.
Yeah. More of a family love. Mm-hmm. Love of your children and your biological family, mm-hmm. your relatives. The love you feel for other people. Mm-hmm. Which could be very closely related to clinging. Mm-hmm.
Boy, I wish I'd brought the Metta Sutta with me. You don't happen to have it, do you?
No, I didn't carry it around. Like
some, you know, well, Sylvia does, so I thought you might.
But I will say this about that in passing. Thank you for prompting that. I mean, the analogy that's given there, Metta is the word for loving kindness, okay? And so in that, the analogy is given that as a mother loves her only child,
yeah.
So right there is the family attachment you're talking about. It's held up as the highest standard. As a mother loves her only child, so too, you should fill your mind with boundless loving kindness for all beings in all directions, with no distinction among them. That's the aspiration. Mm-hmm.
Mm. And my favorite phrase in the sutta, just to add on to that, which really brings out what Rick's saying is, you know, it goes through all these different categories, old and young, tall and short, you know, joyful and not joyful, all the different kinds of beings that exist, to incline our minds to open to all of them. And then there's a phrase that says, omitting none. And when Sylvia had us a few years ago study that sutta and really study carefully the words in there, I actually took it as my practice for. It's still my practice, but I took it very, very more carefully for over a year to actually work with omitting none, as in not just nice poetry in the sutta, but actually to work with it in daily life. And in that, if you really take that on as a practice, it's all about love. It's all about love.
I'll bring you a copy of that, because Sylvia gave us a copy. So I'll bring a bunch of the copies, but I'll make sure to give you one next week or the next week. Mm-hmm. Have it. Because it says exactly what Rick said, is the family is right there. So I'll bring a bunch of them.
Thanks, Alex. Bill, when you used the word clinging, mm-hmm. I sort of struck you might want to think about that, because I don't think clinging is in fact a characteristic of mothering. It's probably something else.
I thought you were bringing it up. You were raising the question that I think is embedded in what Bill's saying. I mean, is it a form of clinging, and what's the fine line, right, between healthy and unhealthy attachment? I think that's right in the center of this right here. And if it's okay, it's a question that's been gripping me lately a lot, mm-hmm. and just very super briefly on it. In the classical teaching of the Buddha, and then as always, see for yourself what makes sense to you, there's a distinction that's made, and I'll do it in terms of two words, between tanha, which translates as thirst. It's craving. Okay? If you vaguely recall the sequence of events, we make contact with something. If it's pleasant, then craving for it to continue arises. If it's unpleasant, craving for it to go away arises. All right? That's what Manning was getting at with that meditation instruction. What's your attitude toward the present moment? What's the attitude of mind to the present moment? Right? It's kind of automatic. And it's what an organism does. It approaches the pleasant, it avoids or fights the unpleasant. That's tanha, thirst. He has that kind of very visceral feeling to it. That craving leads to clinging, which leads to suffering in the classic model. Then there's this other really cool word, though. It's called chanda. Just feels good in your mouth when you say it, chanda. Let's all say chanda. Anyway. And it is wholesome desire, like for enlightenment, or for the happiness of your children, or your friends, or omitting none, the whole wide world. That's chanda. And it is desire that is wholesome to have and expresses wholesomeness, and it takes wholesome objects. So I think that's a form. I mean, I think that's the kind of love that has the least suffering in it for oneself and others. It's a love that wishes well without any clinging. You know, trying to. Did you want to say more? Yeah, please.
I can go without having it. I can go without grabbing it. Freedom from grasping is everlasting.
She does this stuff on the spot. Genius at it. Say your name for everybody, too.
Mother Divine.
Mother Divine. You never know what happens when you open up a question. Thanks, Karne.
Another trivial question from Karne.
What about love? Back to you. Back to your prepared remarks.
I'm for change. You know, on the chanda thing, a word more on the chanda thing. It's actually chanda, or another way to look at chanda is actually a neutral word. And it's applied to different, it's a little like tofu, you know. It's neutral and it can be paired with, you know, prepared with other foods and spices and such. And so chanda is about desire, and it can go towards sensual desire, or it can go towards, I think what Rick was really talking about is dharma chanda, which is really desire for awakening, desire for freedom. And you know, so the chanda can be channeled in whatever direction we choose. Whether it's, you know, whether it's whatever chakra, you can put it that way, whatever chakra you like. So I thought I would start a little just by talking. Were most people? Raise your hand if you weren't here for the instructions, the meditation instructions, just so I have an idea. Okay, so because Rick referred to the instructions, and I just thought I'd say a word about them, and it's really. It's a style of practice. You know, in Burma alone, I believe, our teachers brought this practice here mostly from their teachers who are Burmese and Thai, essentially. Some of them they met in India and other places, but they come from, several lineages in Burma and Thailand for the most part. But in Burma alone, there's like 70 different styles of practice. So in a way, what has come our way is not arbitrary, because it's been selected and it has, you know, our teachers found it powerful and they passed on certain forms and not others. But in recent years, they've been exposed to other forms that are interesting. And this the flavor of instruction that I was giving is the flavor that has grab the attention of a lot of our teachers these days and is being practiced was essentially the flavor that I practiced with this fall at IMS for 3 months, which is really a very simple instruction of sit and know that you're sitting. And then begin to know other objects as they arise. And you'll notice that I purposely didn't include the breath in the list, which I have always started with and ended with and perseverated, included quite a bit. And the breath isn't excluded in the instructions. I did it just to kind of unhook us from the familiar assumption that the breath is the foundation of practice. Because what this style of practice reminds us is that it's not about following particular objects, it's about freeing the mind from clinging, ultimately. And certainly following objects or being with objects is a powerful method for doing so, for freeing the mind. It's a very good method. But it's also, it's easy to somehow kind of get familiar with the method in such a way that we forget what it's about. So I found it really powerfully helpful to take on this style of practice for the fall and beyond for a while, just to really, first of all, because it's very gentle and it's very relaxed and it's very simple. We know that many of us Westerners get most caught in practice is around self-criticism and is around striving and doing it right, and the style of this practice really invites us to let go of that, I think, and to really just, there's such simplicity. You know, Joseph Goldstein, who's the one of the senior teachers in the U.S. and the guiding teacher at IMS. You know, one of the examples, if someone's having trouble with the style of practice, he says, just do this. Just get mindful for a moment and actually just slowly lift your arm like this. Try it. Just take a moment and do it with awareness. Just actually lift your arm across like that and know that you're doing it. Anyone have trouble doing that? It's really simple. Like, it's like we can all do it, you know? You know, I can uncross my leg and put it down there with awareness of what I'm doing and feel my foot hit the floor. And in a very real way, the practice is no more complicated than that. It's sitting and knowing that we're sitting. It's breathing and knowing that we're breathing. It's thinking and knowing that we're thinking. It's not about eliminating this or that and doing more of this or that, but it's about knowing exactly what we're doing. And the second part of the instruction is really about the attitude of the mind and knowing the attitude of the mind and the invitation is to check in occasionally with the attitude of the mind. So even if you're blissed out or absorbed, or particularly if you're stuck in having difficulty, to see, am I grasping? Am I pushing away, rejecting? Am I waiting for something to happen or leaning towards? I mean, how many of us have done this, right? Remember, just think about the best sit you've had in the last 3 months, or one of the really wonderful sitting experiences you've had. Anybody here not sit down once in the next 7 times they sat and think, maybe I can get that back? You know, I mean, it's so natural. We have a good meditation experience and we want to recreate it. And that's the attitude of attachment, not the attitude of freedom. So this is what I did on my fall vacation, which is really just being with experience as it arises and knowing it as transitory and knowing more and more the attitude of my mind as it was happening. I I can tell you a few of the things that I want to just kind of open it up a little bit more, because I have a lot of thoughts and a few things written down. I don't want to give a cogent Dharma talk on some list tonight. I know that I'm imagining that some of you want to hear more about the retreat. I also can just talk about this style of practice a little bit more, which is a lot of the retreat. And I'm also just open to questions and seeing where we go with questions. So if there's a strong preference in the room, I'd like to know it.
This is my standard question. Insight. It is insight meditation. Mm-hmm. You've all heard me say this before already. I'd like to hear you talk about the experience of insight.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and what that's like.
Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to. I'm not going to do it right off though. But tap me if I forget to come back to it, because it's a great question. I'll say a little bit more. Oh, go ahead.
Just another thing is, I am actually really curious about IMS, and I always want to go there in the fall time, uh-huh. because I like the East Coast in the fall time. So I would actually love to hear that.
It's such a gorgeous place in the fall. It's really just practicing in the autumn. Mm-hmm. It's such a beautiful, beautiful environment. And then it gets really cold. Mm-hmm. I can say one thing right off the bat, that if the primary place you've practiced is Spirit Rock, as was true for me, it's not like Spirit Rock in a lot of ways. It's much more like an Asian monastery in a certain kind of way, because the Spirit Rock is really thoughtfully built, and the retreat center is away from the hubbub of daily activity and the administration many of the other activities of the center. So at IMS, you walk out of the meditation hall and you're right near the front door, and the UPS guy can walk right in. And the staff are walking through, taking care of maintenance, or on their way. There's all these offices upstairs, so it's very different in that way. There's a whole another retreat center there called the Forest Refuge, which is, so I would say Spirit Rock in a way is the retreat center at Spirit Rock is sort of in between the IMS retreat center, which is more integrated into daily life, and the Forest Refuge, which is even quieter than Spirit Rock, and quite a real retreat center in the woods. But I think one of the things that happens when you go on long retreat is that you discover all the expectations you had that you didn't know you had. And I had some of those, that it would be like Spirit Rock in certain ways, and in certain ways it was, and in many ways not. So. And I don't think it makes sense for me to catalog all of those, except to say, the food is different, the staff is different, the grounds are different, there is a difference between the guiding teachers and the spirits that they convey, and there's many threads that are similar too. So it's a great opportunity to kind of branch out and see what else, how you relate to different styles of practice and different, it's like a different branch in the family tree.
Question.
Yeah.
Sydney.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
I was curious about the day in and day out. What happens? I mean, do you go there and you gradually get into it? It's so long.
Yeah.
You gradually get into it. Do you find as the days go on that it's more comfortable physically and mentally? And do you kind of pace yourself, or do you have this big aha breakthrough thing at some point? Or it's just hard to imagine in 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, first of all, structurally, there on longer retreats, I know at Spirit Rock at the end of the 2-month retreat, there's a few days of integration. Not so much at the beginning end, though. At IMS for 3 months, we actually had close to 3 full days of an integration program going in as well as coming out, so 3 days on each end. So we actually did some community building and did a circle and did, as well as meditating, and did chores together and did some service to the center. There was a volunteer service and did tours of the Forest Refuge and the Barry Center for Buddhist Study and things like that. So there's an opportunity to really kind of become a community a little bit before we went into silence, and then on the other end as well to get to know people, you know, because I always compare it, it's a little, when you sit for that long with people, it's a little bit like having war buddies, you know, or, you know, because you've been through, you don't know the content of what other people have been through in most cases, but you know that they've been through it, like you have. And there's a bonding that happens that's really powerful. The time, you know, one of the metaphors, one of the comments about long retreat that I think is true is it can feel, for those of you who've seen the movie, it's a little bit like Groundhog Day, you know. You know, there you are again at the same table eating the same oatmeal, you know, with the same cast of characters surrounding you again, you know, for the 43rd time, you know. And it's, you know, or filing in and out of the meditation hall in, you know, roughly the same order. You know, there's that guy. He's hungry again, you know. You know, who goes first and who goes last, you know, so there is this incredibly repetitive quality to it, which depending on the moment can feel excruciatingly boring or incredibly comforting, and it's a container for practice. And so what you see is real, you know, I think really what it offers ultimately is the chance to see the emptiness of all phenomena, you know, that so much happens that we are so invested in all the time. You know, I can tell you about the day that I got to lunch and there was no more chard and how many hours I was upset about that, you know. Because I wasn't eating certain other things, and so what I was left with was slabs of tofu and white rice, you know. I wasn't so happy about that. And then, now where is that experience now? Or where is that upset now? Or where was it even though I was upset about it for a few hours, I can admit, you know. Where was it later that evening? You know, where was it, it's important. So when we think about all the things that we get so worked up about or have so many responses to, and then poof, they're gone, you know. We see that over and over and over when we're on long retreat. And I think what it really, there was a phrase that one of the teachers in training, he gave a beautiful talk, and he talked about a phrase that I loved. He talked about, it gives you the opportunity to really marry your own life, you know, and as it is, instead of the way that we tend to really do this thing of, I'll take that part, not that part, that part, more please, not that part, you know, and we want, you know, our lives as they're not, really, a lot of the time, and so it gives you the chance to just be with the repetition and the container. It really, you know, there are some days you just wake up and you can't believe you're doing it again, you know, but then you can notice that the mind is, you know, we use these words like boredom, but if you really get underneath and pay attention, it's not boredom. Boredom is like depression. It doesn't really mean anything in and of itself. It's an umbrella term, and underneath it there's shades of thousands of other experiences. There's annoyance, and there's happiness, and there's There's just so many other things going on to pay attention to, so it forces you back. The fact that there isn't stimulation, there aren't dinner options, there isn't entertainment options, there aren't all the ways that we have to distract ourselves. We can't just pop in a VCR, you know, or a DVD, or whatever, when we'd like to change the channel. It just keeps you coming back to what is. And if you do that long enough, what I think, you know, it can be discovered is that really everything that we think is a problem self-liberates eventually. You know, just like the charred question did. You know, it really didn't matter. Someone quoted at the one of the teachers, Sharda, many of you may know her, quoted Jack Kornfield. Someone asked a question at one point, like a very earnest question. One of the students, you know, was like, "So, you know, I've learned so much here, and how do I take it home?" And Sharda quoted Jack Kornfield saying, "This is not the store. This is the dump." You know, and I really, really, really found that to be true. It's not a place you go to accumulate things, including insights, by the way. But it's a place where we go to let go, and the insight is the byproduct of the letting go. And that's what the repetition really encourages. Because how many days can you be pissed off at your neighbor who's coughing, really? I encountered numerous conditions that I found incredibly uncomfortable, from my body to my neighbor, certain neighbors, select neighbors, or even policies or the way they ran the center, and I could find. It's incredibly humbling to see how long the mind wants to hold a grudge for. But you know what? Someone quoted also Leonard Cohen, who's a practitioner himself, and has studied intensively with a Zen master, I believe. And the quote. This is a rough translation of the quote, but it was something like, "For the first several weeks, I had sexual fantasies. And for the next several weeks, I had ambition fantasies. And for the weeks after that, I had creativity fantasies. And then the mind just got tired and I quit." Yeah. And that's essentially what happens, I think, is that the mind gets tired of, you know, Rick mentioned that I'm on sabbatical. I had the privilege of having an opportunity to do a lot of travel and study, you know, for a while and practice. And I was, you know, I've been working towards creating this space in my life for numerous years and holding the intention. And I'd wanted to do a 3-month retreat specifically for a long time. And what happens? I get there and here I am. Okay, a 3-month retreat. And what do I spend, you know, a lot of the first 2 weeks doing? Thinking about what I'm going to do when I leave. Imagine that. Imagine that. I mean, the irony of thinking about what you're going to do, you know, when I've been waiting years for the opportunity to actually sit down in an uninterrupted way. That was humbling, you know. Fortunately, it ends. Or the intensity of it, or the grasping around it ends. So I didn't, you know, of course I had recurring thoughts at various times what I might do when I left, but not with nearly the same ferocity or the suffering, you know, that came at the beginning when I was, you know, chewing endlessly on the possibilities of interesting things I could do when I left. There's a quote from a book which I'm not familiar with directly, but I think it's called Women of the Way. Some of you may know it, and it goes like this. She opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. I think that captures it pretty well. So after a while, the mind settles, and what we've been really reactive to, we can remain poised around, or less affected by, or less thrown by. And really recognizing, I think one of the insights is that comes in the knowledge, it comes in the recognition that it's just phenomena arising, rather than the stories that we attach to them. You know, the other possibility when I came in and there was no chard was just to say unpleasant. Just to notice how upset I was. Rather than to spin a story about how, you know, the kitchen staff is messing up and, you know, can't they get anything right around here and blah, 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 you know, blah, blah. So instead of spinning a tragedy or a tragic story, just to notice not getting what I want. It's only a mind state. It's only a mind state. Imagine, you know, if every time someone flipped us off in traffic, we could just say it's only a mind state. Instead of the temptation to flip them, you know, back off or whatever. I want to say another word or two about the Utejaniya style. A great quote from him, he says, it's not difficult to be aware. It's difficult to be aware continuously. Simply reminding yourself to be in the present is all you need. That's Utejaniya, who's the teacher behind this flavor of practice that's caught on in recent years in the West. His name is Utejaniya. Utejaniya. I think it's Tejaniya or something like that. He's in Burma. He was at IMS last year, but I don't think we'll be in the West again anytime soon. Excuse me?
It sounded a lot like
Thich Nhat Hanh. Mm-hmm. I think there is some similarity in the flavor. I think the other thing that I just want to say a few words about is about, you know, I'm sure you've heard Rick talk and other teachers about the whole thing about no self. And that's one, I think, for many of us, you know, it's easy to get impermanence, things change. It's harder to grasp this thing about no self. You know, who am I if I don't have a self, right? And we're just such an individualistic culture. And one of the aspects, you know, the Pali word anatta, you know, there's different aspects of it, you know, no solid self, no enduring self. But one of the aspects of it that really became clearer to me, that was emphasized to me, that I really hadn't understood, that Rick and I talked some about a couple of weeks ago, is this aspect of ungovernability. And I think you're probably felt a little bit of it in the instruction, because we don't say, try and make the mind do this. We say, be aware of what is in that instruction. And the aspect of coming to peace with the ungovernability of the mind is just that, you know, when I told you about sitting down and planning what I was going to do after the retreat, I knew it wasn't what I was there for. But it was just what was happening. It was what my karma was, what the causes and conditions that create this mind stream was up to. And I could go, you know, I could and did go, stop that, you know, as many times as I want to, it doesn't work that way to stop it. What works is to really be, to surrender to the truth of what is. And I think part of what I got there is really learning the distinction between wanting truth and loving truth. Anybody here know Carol Wilson? She's an IMS teacher. She comes out to, I actually think she's at Spirit Rock teaching now. And this was something I really got from her, just that a lot of times we want truth. We want to, you know, it's a little bit like that difference between the store and the dump. We want to go to the store. Loving truth is about the willingness to recognize that it's a dump. Loving truth is about being with things as they are. Yes, Betsy.
How is the loving truth and the wanting truth dealing with no self?
With no self? Yes.
When you started there,
Yeah. Well, when we're grasping, we're self, right? And when we want truth, it's a solid self.
I'm not cool with no self.
Yeah.
I just didn't understand how you.
Yes. So what I'm so my answer is that when we're stuck in wanting, when the attitude of the mind is gimme, you know, I went to hear this talk and I really, you know, had to know X, you know. Or I went on the 3-month retreat and I was determined by the end I was never going to think about the future again, you know, or some such grasp, right? That's solid self, you know, the fist clenching. You know, when we love truth, we're open to what arises. You know, the hand unclenches and takes what's offered. Including, oh, here I am obsessing about what I'm going to do when I after this. That's how it releases, not stop that. So the ungovernability is just, it's a powerful window, I think, into really recognizing that however willful we think we are, however in control of our lives we think we are, if we sit down for long enough, what will arise will have, you know, we will not be able to predict, we will not be able to control. It just is what it is. And the more we sit, you know, the longer we sit, some of the value of sitting for an extended retreat is just being able to see that ever so clearly, that whatever idea I have about what should be happening, what I'd like to be happening, what I wish were happening, that it has so little correlation to what is happening.
Yeah. If I could just underscore something here, a distinction that we've talked a little bit about, a fair amount in the past, is the distinction between, I think, of the two wings of practice, the two wings of personal growth, being with and working with. Mm-hmm. Right? Both are really important. And Annie is talking here about an epitome of what? Being with. I mean, it's a radically bare being with practice. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a way to think about it. And so we have about 5 more minutes.
Yeah,
I don't know if you want to get to John's question about
that.
I personally think being with is senior, because you can always be with, you can't always work with. Mm-hmm. Right? But on the other hand, I would say this, sometimes I think being with is held up, particularly in certain Buddhist circles, as the only way to go, or as, you know, the best way. And it's really, really strongly clear that in the Buddha Dharma, there's a lot of talk about cultivating wholesome qualities, developing over time, etc. So, you know, both are really important. Even though I personally think being with is senior, especially for Westerners, you know, including for myself, you know, a majorly working with kind of guy. So I've gotten a lot of value from working with being with.
I can be with working with.
That's right.
And there's, you know, many great, you know, when you go on retreat, as many of you have, there's talks about more the being with side, and then there's talks about the working with side, and they're both, they work hand in hand. And what I would say to try and move towards John's...
I'm sorry, John. I don't think it's important to address that question.
Well, it's a good question. So I'm not going to try and address it in full, but what I want to say is, in this process of being with what is and seeing how we cling and hopefully letting go more and more, you know, Nibbana is understood in the Buddhist scripture and through teachers as the destruction of greed, hatred, and illusion. And that's the ultimate destruction, the pulling up of the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. Moments of freedom involves the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. And they're the building blocks, in a way, if you would, toward allowing Nibbana to take root. And that's what's implicit in the instruction of what's the attitude of the mind right now. Ultimately, it boils down to, are we at this moment clinging, leaning forward, grasping, pushing away, rejecting, wanting something else, or are we in fact fully aware and content with what is? So I'll read you a short entry from my journal from the retreat, and maybe it'll bring out some of the flavor. Practice is like surfing. You're hanging out waiting for a good ride. Sometimes the right-sized waves come in, like right in quotes, sized waves come in in orderly intervals. But lots of times there's lulls and there's quiet and you have to wait, or they come relentlessly and maybe too strong for our liking. Anyhow, this is how it is. They come as they come, and there ain't a darn thing we can do about that. The thing we can do is try not to cling, and when we do, try to be okay with that. Ah, so this is wanting, or this is aversion. Just being with the truth of our suffering and perhaps offering ourselves as much compassion as we can in our situation as it is, whatever it looks like. I think that's the flavor. Any last questions or comments? Please.
So in a nutshell, now that you are not in retreat, this is a common question, how do you continue your practice?
Quite happily. It's so important, the integration piece. I think, you know, again, one of the beauties of being able to practice in an extended form is that the habit, there's new conditioning that takes place. There's more reinforcement. It does, you know, when I've gone on 10-day retreats, you know, there's a momentum that carries forward a little bit, and then life quickly, the busyness of life quickly returns, and it's harder to hold on to those insights or those new habits or the open-heartedness as easy, you know, for very long. And what I'd say is that for longer retreat, it just creates new conditioning, and that's what becomes clear, is that it's not I'm a good person or I'm a bad person or I'm a good practitioner or a bad practitioner. If I practice, I'll be happier. If I practice longer, I'm more likely to be happier. And perhaps softer, perhaps less forgiving, or even on the way over here in traffic, less worried that I was going to be late, you know, or that was a problem. Just less conditioned to be tense in some way, or to hold on to the ungovernability of the world I live in. So that's a short answer. It's a great big question. Yeah. I'd like to share, maybe in closing, a little quote or two.
And then I'll make a couple quick announcements, very brief announcements.
In spiritual practice, time is not a factor. If we engage fully, the whole path will unfold. So that's from Manindra, who was one of Joseph and other people's teachers. There's a poem I'd like to read also, which moved me very much when I heard it. It's a short poem by a 12th century nun named Rengetsu. It's called On Seeing Young Nuns on Their Begging Rounds. First steps on the long path to truth. Please, do not dream your lives away. Walk on to the end.
Thank you, Manny. Mm.
Thank you.
Friend and teacher.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, an honor.
Founding Father. We have a Declaration of Liberation. Manny signed it, It was a vanishing ink, his selflessness. Let's make that up. Okay, let's see. Any thanks to those people who bring the munchies. All right, so Gus, I know you. Come on, who else has brought food here? Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's great. And whoever else wants to bring food, it's wonderful. It's great. Second, if you'd like to, through generosity, offer Donna for tonight, there's a bowl back there. It'll go in. Let's see. Manny, I made an announcement that Manny would be here next week. He won't be because he's going to wander the earth like Cain and go do other things. So next week, my intent in the context of your practice, I want to name a couple of quick themes. Next week, I want to talk about abandoning fault finding, especially in oneself. That's a great beginning for a year of practice because it's so easy to find fault with oneself and then give up and get angry and withdraw, what have you. So, and in this context of all conditions just arise and whirl away, right? What is there to find fault with? So that's going to be the next one. The one after that, I want to raise the topic of diversity. Both the obvious isms, race, religion, sexual orientation, gender, but for me, actually more profound forms of diversity of just individuality of temperament and brain and need and time and practice. And diversity is a way of doing things, not a topic, but an approach, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And it's very important also for this group to be welcoming to people of all sorts. And then after that, we're going to start sliding into the formalities of Sila. Remember, this year we're going to go through Sila, Samadhi, Pranayama, which are the foundations of practice, which is to say virtue, concentration, and wisdom, virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom. And one of the foundations of Sila are the five precepts. Don't harm anyone, don't steal, don't lie, etc. And that's going to be very interesting to go through. We'll start with non-harming, particularly of oneself. Okay, so that's the general plan. It should be very cool, very far out. Anyway, I think that's it. Any other quick announcements? Quick warning, if you park, alas, this nice woman came here and parked a couple weeks ago in the Kaiser lot. And it may be open when you enter, but it is gated when you come back. And you cannot get your car out of there. They will just not let you have your car back for the morning. So just be very careful about that. Anything else? So wonderful to see everyone. It's great. Growing. It's wonderful. Thank you. Vows. See you next week.
Thank you.
And this week you might play around with this attitude that Manny brought forward. What's the attitude of mind? This inquiry. What's the attitude of mind? Thank you, Bill. Got your name right this time for the insight question. See you next week. Sorry, you're hooked up, man. We're not going to let you go.